Hello, welcome to the Tuesday night discussion group. We're discussing again this week, God Does Not Want You to Be in Pain, by myself, Eric Watson, and my buddy that's on the phone, Walter Oleski. We are going to be discussing chapters two this week, Eric's journey, chapter two, and Walt's journey, chapter two. They're full of things that we talk or ideas, concepts, and insights that we talk about all the time in the TMS wiki and the TMS healing knowledge, TMS penicillin, which is awareness, you know, affirmations, acceptance, repressions, how to come to a decision, you know, like in the road of acceptance, how the problems are internal and external and so forth. So we're going to be getting into these tonight, and the ignore methods, and how to, if we're going to ignore pain, how do you ignore pain, you know? So we'll be discussing things like that. And Walt's chapter's full of repression work and journaling and just all these good ideas. And we're really excited about this chapter, and we're going to be going into it. I'm going to go ahead and give the disclaimer now. Before we start, I do need to let everyone know that this is a peer support group. None of us are medical or mental health professionals. If you have a medical concern, you should see a properly licensed physician, or a TMS physician, as we like to say. Now, with that being said, we got Bruce MC to give us the summary. Bruce?
Well, I think tonight we're dealing with Eric's journey and with Walt's journey. It wakes.
That's right.
Yeah. And that, well, yeah, Walt's journey chapter one is really chapter two.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. In the context of the book. And, this is Walt's version of, in which he provides a lot of advice on techniques to use to eliminate your TMS pain. And now when Walt talked to Steve Ozanich, the author of The Great Pain Deception, Steve replied, when he talked to him about his background, his family history, Steve said that just from reading about his boyhood memories, Walt's boyhood memories, the ones he posted about his parents divorcing, remarrying, moving almost annually, you know, no stable home, living with little security and lots of family anger, Walt was what Steve called a perfect storm for TMS. And in this chapter, Walt gives a lot of advice on different techniques to use to free yourself of pain. And of course, number one of them is following the Dr. Sarno's 12 daily reminders, the ones in healing back pain. And he adds on with a rejoinder that it may happen in a day, 2 or 4 weeks, maybe longer. He says, stick with it. Then he goes into journaling. And this is based on, I gather, Sarno's methodology for journaling that he outlines in The Divided Mind. Dr. Sarno says that you should deal with past traumatic events in childhood and early adulthood, and these are things to journal on, and also journal on current pressures, and then you can journal on personality traits. Things like perfectionism and goodism. Because if Walt is a perfectionist, Eric is a goodist. So we have the two typical types here showcased in this book.
I'm actually both.
Way we all find out. We think we're a perfectionist, and then we find out we're a goodist too. Then we think we're a goodist. And then we find out we're a perfectionist likewise.
You're
right. The two go hand in hand, don't they, Walt?
I think they do. You know.
And Walt has advice like when you finish a journaling session, if you've dug up emotions that are disturbing to you, it's better to write something pleasant afterwards. And I don't know how much to emphasize this, but Walt certainly does, that you need to learn to laugh. You need to learn to laugh at yourself and not take these things so seriously, because laughter's the best medicine because of the various neurobiological changes it affects in your brain. And he says these three lists can be past or childhood events, current stressors, and personality characteristics, just like I said. And he talks about a lot of the techniques that are in the structured education program on the TMS wiki, for example, like fast writing. You write about issues in a fast and constant motion. By writing faster than normal, a person tends to forget to censor their thoughts, and then they're much more honest. And another technique is unsent letters that you write to people, perhaps in your dead relatives club, that you didn't say these things to when they were alive. What does he say? That he says this technique is especially good for those who have difficulty expressing their emotions to other people, repressed, in other words. And then also something I read about in Dr. Alexander's book about having a conversation with your childhood self from the perspective of what you've learned as an adult, like a wise counselor for your inner child. That's another strategy for journaling.
That's a good one.
Yeah, he has a whole chapter of that his book on mentoring your younger self. And then you talk about one of Dr. Howard Schubner's techniques. What is that? That's spider writing, where you put an issue or a topic in a circle or nucleus in the center of a piece of paper, and then you write 1 to 4 word phrases about the topic in a circle, and you connect them. And then from those topics, you write 4 more and 4 more until it becomes like a spider web on the page. Let's see, you give about, 8 directions for doing this. And I've done it, and it's kind of amazing if you write down perfectionism and then start seeing the things that are associated in your mind with it in a free write. The unconscious starts to speak. It's like, what do they call that? Surrealistic writing. The surrealist did this. And you can see the way you free associate different concepts and ideas in your mind, the things that are buried there. Walt says choose an issue, topic, or event in a list and put it in the nucleus. Spend 5 minutes on the journaling. That's the, again, it combines the quick writing too. And he also advises to relax and breathe deeply. Write down your thoughts and feelings about the topic in 1 to 4 word phrases, and then you draw a circle around these thoughts and connect them to the center nucleus. And you write about any circle on the page, write about the nucleus or another circle connecting it. After writing a new thought about a circle, connect it to the circle that prompted it, and continue this progress until 5 minutes are up, until the clock goes off. You could set one of those little timers, one of those little egg timers or cooking timers. When you're under pressure to bring out these ideas without any censoring, they come out more honestly, I think. And then Walt has advice for if you have trouble sleeping with affirmations, and also counting from 1 to 100 backwards. And he advises about different kinds of foods to eat before you go to bed. What I found is doing a progressive relaxation with deep breathing before you go to bed. I didn't see that here.
you tense each muscle or each part of your body, you tense it, and then you let it go, then you release it. And progressive tension like that is a good technique too. But I found that kept me awake.
Did you? What I found is if
you're concentrating on all of that stuff and you're not thinking to go to sleep. The main things I found for going to sleep and staying asleep is deep breathing and think of some pleasant thing that you want to do. Be on a beach, a sunny beach. If that doesn't work after a while, then that counting really does help. You count backwards from 100 to 1, and sometimes it takes twice to do it, and almost always if it takes the third one before I'm, you know, just 10 or 20 into the third round, I'm asleep.
What is it? You can't pay attention?
If you focus your mind on anything, you're going to stay awake.
Oh, and
you gotta do not ever try to do your journaling when you're in bed trying to sleep. That'll keep you awake. You don't do anything. You try to let your mind, you know, it's meditation. You just try to let your mind relax and think of warm sunlight shining on you on a warm beach and breathe deeply while you're thinking about that.
Well, I do the progressive relaxation while I'm doing the deep breathing. I correlate it with the tension. For example,
if it works for you, that's fine.
Yeah, but I find it works if I do it at 3 a.m. just before I go into REM sleep. I have to wake up and do it.
Thanks.
I want to go to
bed at 9 or 10 o'clock at night and stay asleep the whole night.
Yeah, you talk about
dreaming. Usually I wake up because I got to go to the bathroom. But I can usually go right back to sleep afterward if I do the deep breathing for a few minutes. But everybody has, you know, different things work for different people.
So true. Well,
yeah. But I find that it's very, very important to spend an hour or at least an hour before bedtime. Don't watch TV. Don't read the newspaper. Don't think of anything that is a problem or that can excite your mind. Let your mind relax. Listen to some music or just quiet. It's awful hard to be quiet.
I like how you said, Walt, to focus your mind on one thing. And that is basically the method, you know, when you go to a hypnotherapist, they'll get you to focus your mind on one thing. And if you're not careful, you can go to sleep, you know, because you got your mind focused on one thing, you know. And
sure.
When you mentioned focus your mind on one thing and make sure it's a good thing, I really like that because that's one of the something that really helps me go to sleep is to get my mind focused on one thing. And with Bruce,
and
when he said visualizing
a tranquil environment.
Yeah.
Visualize yourself on a sunny beach somewhere, and then listen to the sounds of the birds, of the wind in the trees, the water lapping against the shore. Try to involve all of your senses in your visualization, and then you're more apt to actually be there. And imagine that the sun is enveloping your entire body. You're stretched out on a blanket or something on a beach, and the sun is totally engulfing you. And what the sun is God. It's God shining his light on you. That's how I feel.
Sounds like John Donne.
I don't know.
Yeah, they use that. That's a classic medieval trope.
The sun. See, in the medieval times, they had time to think about solutions to anxiety and stress and all the rest of it. We have these little cell phones and all this technological little stuff that's in front of us and TV, and we're distracted. In the, you know, in the old days, even 50 years ago, I'll tell you, there were less distractions, and we were able to sit and think more peacefully. Now it's hard to think peacefully. There's we're bombarded by so much information and technology. That's why I think a lot of people have TMS. They're overstimulated with information from the media. You know, we didn't even know where Afghanistan was 10 years ago. Now it's the big, you know, problem in our lives. We can't help but tune it out.
Powerful thoughts.
I think the more we
British
can
had
find,
quite a time.
No, the other day at Easter, two of my nieces said, "Oh, Walt, we've got to get you signed up with Skype, so yeah. We can see you on the computer and all of that." And I said, "Hey, I want less social media, electronic socialization. Come out and see me sometime," like Mae West said. But no one ever comes out to see anybody. They want everybody to come to them.
Yeah, I know. I have to say, though, I think it's pretty special that your nieces wanted to reach out to you like that. I think that was
nice.
That's pretty cool.
But, you know, I'm 84. Why should I drive out to see them? They never come to see me. Never. But they say, "Yeah, we'd like to see more of you. Come and visit us." Well, the hell with that. I'm not in the mood to drive an hour and a half to see them. I'm too busy, for one thing. They're not really busy, these two nieces, one of them anyway. She just reads books about vampires and watches sports on TV. Well, get in the car and drive out and see Uncle Walt. I just have enough technology now. I don't need Skype. Well, anyway, we're off subject here. We're trying to keep things on how to relax before bedtime.
Well,
good point, and I think
part of your advice.
We've covered that pretty well, though. I think that is a very, very interesting thought. What's next, Bruce? Sorry to interrupt.
One of his other Walt's other admonitions is to practice deep breathing.
The number one thing.
I noticed you say that the most important thing is that the exhale is longer than the inhale, and that's
what I read.
Dr. Andy Weil says that.
That's the way I do it. You're blowing out all the impurities when you blow out longer than you inhale. You're blowing out all the impurities to where most of the time we inhale longer than we exhale.
And you're supposed to keep that in mind when you exhale, that you're getting rid of all those stresses and tensions and worries that are in your mind. You're getting rid of it.
In addition, there's a relatively new body of research called heart rate variability, maybe in the last 15 years. And it turns out that our breathing can control our heart rate. And typically, as we are inhaling, the heart rate increases, perhaps in anticipation of the fact that you've got more oxygen and it wants to take advantage of that. Whereas when you're exhaling, the heart rate will decrease. So if you want to relax the heart and slow your system down, it makes sense to spend more time on the exhalation, because that's what slows your heart down.
Sounds good.
Plus, when you hold it.
It's only a matter of seconds, you know. You can't hold it in and then breathe it out.
You still got to breathe.
You got to breathe. So, you know, I breathe in through the mouth. I mean, through the nose. You breathe in through the nose, to the count of five or six, and then you hold it for about that much, and then you breathe it out a little longer through the mouth.
Could you tell us a little bit more about this valley point?
That's a good one. Yeah, that's an acupressure thing that I learned about from a DVD called Tai Chi for Seniors, but it can be Tai Chi for anybody. And one of the things that he says is the most used in acupressure is to use your thumb and index finger, like the right hand, and go to the left hand to the fleshy point between the thumb and index finger. And just massage that fleshy area, which they call the valley point. And I do that about 25 times. It only takes a second or two, 25 seconds. And then you switch and you take your left hand, thumb and index finger, to the valley point on the right hand and do the same thing 25 times. It's very, very relaxing. And it relieves any time when your mind is being overworked or worried about anything.
If you reach across and grab the other side between your pinky and your third finger at the same time that you press that valley point, that's also amazingly calming.
I didn't know about that. Your index finger and then the finger next to it?
Yeah, in the above the knuckles, just across from valley point on the other side.
I see.
My acupuncturist said that'll make you just straighten out your back if he grabs it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, it's also like in karate. That's the way to get control of somebody who comes up and tries to grab you. You can make them into your puppy with that.
Isn't that interesting?
You can bring them right down.
Thank you for telling me about that. I didn't know about that one.
Well, you know, it's like karate and tai chi and yoga, all of this stuff.
Well, those Eastern people, they had time to think about those things. They didn't have cell phones or telephones and computers and all the rest of this stuff. They sat under a tree in the shade and thought, how can I relax? Well, I'll try this, I'll try that. And some of it works, and some of it has been passed down to us.
Yeah, and you say a big thing is be at peace with others, with yourself, with the Lord, and also practice forgiveness. Now, that's
definitely
a big one in ISTDP, too.
Well, I found a good path toward forgiveness is to put yourself in the other person's shoes. I was angry at my parents for divorcing and yelling in the house and all the rest of it. And when I started to think, well, gee, they had stressful lives. They had hard jobs. They had to pay the bills and keep the kids in shoes, my sister, brother, and me, and food on the table. They had a lot of stresses during the 1930s depression, when it was a miracle to have any kind of job at all. And my mother used to work. The only job she could get was ironing shirts in a Chinese hand laundry.
Mm-hmm.
And she would go there an hour early every morning, an hour early, so she could get an ironing board near a window to get some air, because it would be 90 degrees in the laundry with no fan or anything. And she's using a hot electric iron to iron shirts all day. So when I started to think the stresses and the TMS that they were under, I got into putting myself in their shoes. It led me to forgive, sympathize, empathize, and forgive.
Well, it's like in 19, 37, they had an advertisement for a elevator operator in the Sutter Building in downtown San Francisco. And that was one of the tallest tallest office buildings in the financial district at the time. Well, that was a good job because you could sit there all day and run the elevator. And my aunt and my mother went down to apply for it, and they went down at 5 a.m. There were already 1,100 people running up around the street.
Those were the good old days.
That's when there, yeah, that's what's called no work. That is what the United States
was like. My father was a very good auto mechanic, but there were no jobs for him. Mm-hmm. So he got a ice cream wagon from the Good Humor people that he walked around with, and he stood on a street corner with the ice cream where people would buy an ice cream bar or ice cream cone for 5 cents, and he spent the whole day trying to sell, you know, a nickel here and a dime there. And at the end of the day, well, my brother, who was about 12 at the time, 10 or 12, he also had an ice cream wagon, a Good Humor ice cream wagon, and he was selling the ice cream on the opposite corner at an intersection where my father was. And people would feel more sorry for my brother, the boy, than they did for my father. So my brother used to come home with more nickels and dimes than my father. Well, imagine how that melts. I've started to think how my father felt about that.
Yeah.
So you put yourself in the shoes of the person that's bugging you, and you start to think they had reasons for taking it out on you. You were just handy, so they took it out on you.
I'll bet my parents used to have big fights in 1955. When we were living out in Bayview Hunters Point, out by the shipyard, by the city dump, by the San Francisco city dump, which was a huge ghetto. And I bet the reason they had fights was because in 1955, the shipyards were shutting down.
My
father's livelihood was threatened. And that's when we
moved that's the big one.
Yeah, but
worrying about your job. Look, today everybody is worried. They're given more work to do for the same amount of money or less, and they're worried they'll be the next one to be laid off. That's hard to handle.
Yeah,
so they get angry and they take it out on their child or their wife or their dog. Some people take it out on their dog. And You have to figure they're holding it in, or they're letting it out on you. I think we ought to let Herbie get to his chapter, because he has such good healing techniques to tell about.
Well, that's a good point.
The end of your chapter, Walt, you do emphasize laughter.
Definitely.
Releasing endorphins, natural painkillers into the spinal canal.
Sometimes when things go wrong, I think, actually, life may be a big joke. What else could it be, maybe, except a big joke? I think the Lord had a great sense of humor when he gave us birth. Some of us can handle it better than others. And it took me a long time to learn about TMS, 82 years. But I've learned a lot from it. And I've learned that laughing is a great way to relieve stress.
So I've been very intrigued. Before we move on, I totally agree with what you're saying. Before we move on, I wanted to say that I've been looking into the Valley of Harmony. I think it's interesting. I've been trying to do it, and it's basically, it looks like you have to do it pretty high up in that kind of, in that flesh area between your thumb and your forefinger. Is that true?
Oh, really?
Well,
high up?
Not shallow, not in the skin area, but deep where there's a lot of muscle.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right. You do have to go high up.
Oh, there it is. I found it.
and you just generally gently massage that with about, you said 50 wiggles?
I do it slowly, maybe 25.
And that helps you relax.
Yeah, it Tai Chi meditation part of the tape or the DVD said that anytime your mind is too active or worried, the valley point relaxes it. And it really helped my mother and her friends at the senior citizen house. They it gave them something to do. It may be like rosary beads for some people, or the symbols.
So.
The symbols that the Eastern meditation people use. It's something physical to do that at the same time you're telling your mind that you're relaxing.
I think that's exactly it. It's interesting. There's been some echoes from today's show back to last week's, where we talked a little bit about tapping. And I think that's my interpretation of tapping. I thought I'd mention that this is called the Valley of Harmony, or Hegu, H-E-G-U, point. And I was thinking about it, and I said, I know I've seen this point before. So I started Googling. It turns out we actually have something about this particular point on our affirmations page at the TMS Wiki. tmswiki.org/ppd/affirmations. It's something that we got from Dr. Schubiner's book, if I remember correctly. And he, I think he includes something about the Hegu, and or also known as the Hoku acupressure point, in his book. And that's, I think, exactly the same thing as the Valley of Harmony point that Walt has been describing.
That's very interesting. I want to mention, a lot of people have been emailing, and I mean, they've been posting that they have headaches. I find a very good technique for getting rid of a headache is to just give yourself, your head, a gentle massage. And in fact, the more gentle you touch with your fingers all over your head and your forehead and temples, you would have to pay somebody to give you a head massage. You don't have to pay. You can do it yourself all the time. Whenever you feel like your head is a little, stuffed up or you get a headache. And the back of your head, too. Your neck and the back of the head can massage that area yourself with one hand for a while and then do it with the other hand. I think it is very helpful for headaches.
That makes sense.
Let's throw it over to Herbie, because I know he has a lot of good stuff to cover.
Good idea.
Okay. Herbie, you want to take it over?
Yeah, thank you, Walt. You did good. I wanted to say that to everybody that when Walt wrote it works, it's sort of like what Papa would say or something. That was one of his threads. Of course, it's not the same as the thread on TMS Wiki, but that was one of his threads when he healed. When he healed, he wrote that thread.
Kind of a summary of how I healed.
Yeah, he called it it works. So
that's Three Stooges.
Oh, it's the Three Stooges. Okay.
One of the Three Stooges always said it works.
Yeah, I remember how proud you was that night. You was
Curly, the guy used to do the spin on the floor. He used to say it works.
Yeah, I want everybody to know. I don't think Walt knows this or anybody. I want everybody to know what we're on here. That later on in the chapters, when I talk about the person that got healed that day and how he wrote me about 50 emails, so happy. That person is you, Walt.
I think I just told you
who it was. I never told you that was you, but that was you, buddy.
Yeah, I remember that.
I have all the emails to prove it.
Yeah.
It was good.
Well, it was amazing.
It was journaling. An aha moment day. It was an aha moment day. It's when you realize that, yeah, you know, everything clicked, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it really made me proud. Well, we appreciate you, Walt. You're powerful.
I appreciate all of you, too. We're all a good club of friends.
Yeah, you're a powerful presence. Anytime we get to speak to you and get to learn from you, man, I really appreciate everything you've ever taught all of us.
You too. You've been an amazing amount of information for a lot of people.
Well, thank you. Thank
okay.
you very much.
Go ahead and take it over.
Okay, boss. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Sure. Bye-bye. I'm going to sign off now.
Okay.
Okay. Bye, Walt.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Walt.
Bye-bye. Sure.
Okay, Bruce, what we got going on my section, buddy?
Well, we're dealing with this chapter, chapter two, which is Eric's journey. I think there was a typo there. Walt's chapter have been chapter two also?
Yes, it needs
it says chapter one in the text, and it's entitled Acceptance, Affirmations, Awareness, Reframing, and Reconditioning. And this is more advice from Herbie about how to recover from TMS. But I think the best part of this chapter is actually the classic Americana, the stories. It reminded me a whole lot of reading something by Samuel Clemens, by Mark Twain, in Huckleberry Finn, or Tom Sawyer.
I love the stories.
The night at the bowling alley. I remember going to the Hillsdale bowling alley. It's still down here. That was a place we used to get in trouble. That's where I wasn't supposed to go with Bill Mattersey, who was a bad influence on me. And there used to be cops who would cruise there looking for kids who were up to no good. They would just look around. But Kirby says in this chapter, begins this chapter, he said, I went to a bowling alley with some friends one night. And as usual, he had the pain. So as usual, he drank a whole bottle of Night Train wine, that one immortalized by Guns N' Roses in the song of the same name.
Yeah.
And, also, I remember James Brown. I didn't know what he was talking about in that title, Night Train. But that's what it must be.
It might have been. I'm not sure about that one, but I like that song.
Well, yeah, James Brown, Night Train. That's a great song.
Yeah, I love
song.
James
great
Brown.
Song. Oh, yeah. Who doesn't love James Brown?
Yeah,
a cop came along. He began to wrestle around with his friends out front, and it appeared as if a fight was going on. And a cop came up and said, came out with what you call the handy breathalyzer. Handy-dandy breathalyzer. I like that.
Yeah, they had them all over.
And the charge was underage drinking, and I was guilty. If at 15 I drank a whole bottle of Night Train, I would be inebriated.
I think by then, you know, the pain, using it as a painkiller, I was used to it. My body might not have been used to it, but you know how the mind gets used to the alcohol. So, you know, that was a turning point in my life. That was a point in my life where I started understanding, hey, I can't be out here hanging with these guys and doing all of this, you know?
I know. There comes a point where some people are telling you this is cool and this is the way everybody is. And then you finally wake up one day and say, I just can't keep doing this.
Yeah, that was kind of my story in that. Yeah, it was.
And then you see how
very scary
how your idiot friends turned out later on, too. Once it didn't wise up, then you could figure it out. The charge was underage drinking and I was guilty. And you say that mom wasn't very happy about it, but she came to my rescue as usual. There's some really interesting stuff in here about mom and dad that you lay between the lines, about your father being a natural leader and your mom being very strong and helping you out. It sounds like the the overachieving superego, masculine superego dad, and then the all-forgiving mother who took care of the son and dominated him, perhaps. This may have been the origins of the anger behind your back pain.
Yeah, it had to be. It had to be. You know, I had the protective mom, you know, and I had to be good. I had to be good enough for her. I had to. I was the baby of the family, but at the same time, I had to live up to a certain thing with my mom. I mean, who wants to hurt the mom's feelings, you know? And I couldn't never do wrong in front of mama, and that was her look on me. But I didn't want to lose that from her either. So I worked a lot to, you know, look good in mom's eyes, you know. And then my dad was like a drill sergeant. I mean, the man went on 80-something years old, still working like a 20-year-old, still wanting to box me every day. I remember we put the boxing gloves on one time. I was 18, as I can remember. He was 70 years old. Yeah, he was 70 years old. And with one punch, he knocked me out. Now, I'd done been studying boxing for 2 years at this time. So, you know, yeah, he was the classic, you know, but he was a good guy. He was a real good guy, real big heart, and they did expect a lot from me, and I wanted to live up to it. So, like you said, that's it. Like, that was being between the lines, to live up to that.
Yeah, you know? I wonder, you just put a little bit in there, but you look at it, and then you can figure it out. And, of course, you got a year's probation, thanks to your mother's intercession on your behalf, and you had to, what was it? You had to clean up this hillside when your back was killing you, and your high school coach, Mr. Honeycutt, came by, and we were put to work cleaning an embankment about 400 feet from top to bottom, and then you were betrayed. That cop said, if you do this work really fast and clean it up, then you're going to get off. And you did it. And that gets back to when you said that your natural good nature, you had to guard against people taking advantage of it. And that police did. You said, my strong mom would say my dad was a man's man. I would tell you how many men looked up to him as a leader. So it was in my DNA. I was like them, my mother, aunt, my father, and mother. And it's really how the concentration that you achieve in these stories is like worth its weight in gold in terms of all of the other advice you give. It's like what you talk about dealing with bad conditioning in this chapter by means of awareness, acceptance, releasing, and reframing. And you found that with this pain, you said, my whole life appeared to be leading to a total peak performance, becoming the football player, I guess. And then it went downhill out of control due to the pain. And then you came along where you were, dropping out of high school?
Yes.
Not attending. This was like a slow downhill curve there, wasn't it, from the...
Yeah, because
started.
Up to that young age, everything was going, you know, perfectly as the way it's supposed to be. I was, you know, even at 15, I was already setting records with the weightlifting, and all of a sudden, and all the other things that, you know, a lot of us do in high school, and then the coach notices you, and then the coach, he reaches his hand out for you, and even if you're poor, you know, they'll tell you, they'll help you out, they'll get you the pads and everything. I had to understand that even though I wanted that with all my heart, I knew I couldn't take the hits. I knew that even though I did all of the work I did, I did with the pain in those years. I believe everyone that when they first get this pain at certain times in their lives, they just you know, rough it through it, you know? They just rough through it. So they just get fed up with it. It's there. And if I can get up and move, I'm going to do it anyway, and I'm going to grit my teeth and face it anyway. And
it provides a lot of motivation, doesn't it?
A lot of what now?
Fighting it. A lot of motivation, fighting it.
Yeah. The thing was, is I didn't know that piece of the puzzle, you know, not to focus on it. My mind was strictly on the pain the whole time, you know, and that was the problem. If I could have got my mind on anything else, then even toting the bags, you know, up the hills and all of that, if I could have got my mind on anything else, I'm sure it would have helped. But at the time, all I could think was about that pain in my back, you know. And, of course, I had a lot of stuff going on in my mind that was keeping the pain there too, as in repressions, you know.
Yeah, and how did you feel when you beat the cop in the regional arm wrestling champion, and then he turned on you and said, "I can't do that."
Well, see, by the time I beat him, it was like in my heart, I had to do this because in my mind, I felt like I was about to pass out at any moment from the pain. Okay, middle of summer, we'd been working like four or five hours, and I'd already in my mind felt like I was supposed to pass out. Thing is, I had it also in my heart, I don't want to tell everybody else how bad I'm hurting. Because if you do, then you look like the lone wolf, or you look like the wolf that, you know, it's like evolution. You're going to get, people's going to look at you like a weaker person or something. I didn't want to tell nobody that. But my face was already blood red from the tension. My body was, if there's 11 on the 1 to 10 scale, it was sure at 11. But after I beat him, and when he said that, you know, he couldn't let us off because he'd get in trouble, talk about the tension even going up higher, you know? But I did use it as motivation to go ahead and finish it a lot quicker than we would have so that I could get on home and just lay down.
So did you accept the football, playing football?
No, it had gotten worse by that time. I couldn't go. I had to go ahead and drop out of school at that time. Thank God for GEDs. I went back and got my GED, went back and got me a couple years in college. And I'm really glad that, thank God for GEDs again, you know. I believe a lot of kids, I think we've talked about it before, me and Forrest and you and quite a few other of us, a lot of high school kids going into high school and really wants to make it we've all read the stories where the guy's fixing to make it, and then all of a sudden he has this freak accident, or all of a sudden his back goes out, or all of a sudden his knee goes out, you know? And that was, even though I was already in pain, just the thought of making it to the high school football to be that high school star I wanted to be, and I knew I could be, I believe that kept the pain on. You know, there was other factors, but sometimes you want something so bad, and if you don't know that this wanting so bad could be something negative that's happening on the inside of you, building more rage because you think I might not get it, then that's just something else that you need to know. That's the reason awareness is so important, you know, and acceptance is so important. Being aware of those voices in your head, those feelings in your body that, I can't do this, I'm not good enough. And then where acceptance comes in to let you know that maybe you can't do that, but you can do something else just as good, you know?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you. You say that this is a process of acceptance, awareness, releasing, and reframing. And the right ingredients of this are belief, hope, awareness, reframing, releasing through acceptance. And this is a way of dealing with bad conditioning left over from childhood and your social environment your relationship with your parents. Maybe you could explain that rather than just me going through the chapter.
Yeah, a lot of times if you can be aware, you know, again, you have one of the things I learned. I knew awareness. I knew what awareness was. I knew what acceptance was, but I didn't know what it was in John Sarno's form. I didn't know what it was on being aware of this negative self-talk. I didn't understand the awareness of being aware of your current pressures and how they're bothering you. I didn't understand of being aware of repressions. I didn't understand that. You know, I understood awareness is being in the now, being aware of what's going on around you, sort of like a what's that word? I had a different understanding of what awareness meant. I've talked to people and mindfulness in a way, but a slight form of mindfulness, you know. My awareness to me was being aware of what was going on around me, you know, keeping my eye open, making sure everything was going straight, making sure that nobody was trying to get over on me and stuff like that, you know. Talk from the family what awareness meant. And one of the things in the country we learn is, you know, be aware and not let anybody hurt you, not let anybody run over you and stuff like that. Just a common awareness, you know, not a higher level of awareness that you hear like Dr. Wayne Dyer talk about, or some of the other people that you, some of the greats, the giant shoulders that we read about. Awareness of, again, of, you know, this negative chatter that we hear in our head, like in the Alan Gordon program. He talks a lot about that. Being aware of that, being aware of your negative reactions towards people and events, and just being aware of that, being aware of your repressions, being aware of are you unhappy where you're at, you know, your unhappiness, being aware of your unhappiness, being aware of the voice that's always beating you up and so forth, you know, etc.
Yeah, more emotional awareness.
Yeah,
rather than just being aware of your surroundings and whatever. It's awareness of what's going on inside.
Yeah, and then the next one I mentioned is acceptance, you know. You have to accept that you're going to take the higher ground. You have to get to a point to where you're going to accept, I'm going to believe this. And the true acceptance is accepting that this is what I'm going to do. I accept that this is the way I'm going to do it. Regardless if it's a million different, whatever it might be, if you're going to use true acceptance, then you have to accept that this is the way I'm going to work it. This is the way I'm going to do it. You know, acceptance is also knowing that through awareness, you can catch, you know, like pressures that, or you can catch your reactions and just not react. You have to accept that you can do all this. You have to accept that you can heal. Acceptance can go on and on and on too, because it's one of the higher truths.
You talk about acceptance. Let's see, that comes before awareness, and you say, acceptance is the ability to take information, whether good or bad, and think about it. Then decide the best possible outcome in your mind. Let that thought become your perceived remembrance.
Yes.
You can accept anything in a better light if you make a conscious choice to do so without letting the negative emotions override your decision-making ability, like that negative chatter.
Yes.
It's an ability to recognize a negative thought, worry, or anxiety in your mind.
Yes.
So this brings up an interesting question for me. I mean, and I think it is a bit of a classic question. What's the boundary between acceptance and almost repression? I mean, if you have something that you're unhappy with, and you say, I'm going to accept it, how is that different, and when is that different from essentially repressing and saying, because I think a lot of people, they say, okay, I'm going to accept this, but deep in their heart, they don't totally accept it. So how does one find the way to balance when to practice awareness and to allow the emotion, and when to try and move beyond the emotion to acceptance?
Aren't we talking about that borderline between repression of emotions and suppression? Not letting them overwhelm you, acknowledging them. You suppress them because you can't let them get out of hand.
Yeah, so if you're unhappy at, say, your boss, one thing you can do is you're really angry at your boss, and you can just say, I accept it. I accept that my boss is a jerk, and that's just the way it goes.
Well, one of the things I do if I was really angry at my boss with acceptance, sometimes that's the reason the reframing is in this system that I keep writing out about the acceptance, awareness, releasing, and I got reframing in there too. And reframing is only after if you can't accept, you know, this, say the boss was giving you a hard time and so what you're saying is you're going to agree that you can just hold anger or anything like that at the boss, and you're just going to accept that you're mad at him. I don't think that you can. That ain't what you mean, is it, Forrest?
Well, I'm just. It's just an interesting question, which I guess I've had in the back of my head for a number of years, and It's acceptance. What if part of you doesn't want to accept? What if part of you says, no, I'm not okay with accepting this?
Okay, well, what if it's bad for you? You probably wouldn't need to accept it, you know? It's according, say, if it's something that would be good for you eventually, or good for you not at this time, but maybe at a later time, then how would you accept it? If it's giving you, you know, a bad vibe, I would reframe it. I would take the sting out of whatever it was. I'd have to use a reframe. That's the only way I would be able to accept something that I might have to grow into. The ones that you just have to accept that, you know, you heard it's good for you, you understand it's good for you, but then at a later time, you'll finally understand why it was good for you at a later time. You might have to do a reframe on it, you know? And when I say a reframe, just again, looking at it in a better light. Now, acceptance is looking at things on higher ground, right? Acceptance is accepting what is. It's accepting that things at a higher ground. But acceptance don't always have to be at a higher ground. Acceptance can be, hey, we can agree to disagree with this. You know, that can be an acceptance. You know, you know as much as I do, Forrest. They have whole volumes written on acceptance. But you know, when you start to talk about the higher truths of acceptance, you start to understand that acceptance is, I can do this. Whether it's, a lot of times we've always had those jobs that they're real, real hard, and you have to get through them, and you just have to accept that you got to get through it. And then when you get through it, you get the prize, you know? And it, sort of TMS healing is sort of like that. It's not always pretty as you when you start to heal, you know? 6 weeks later, 7 weeks later, 2 or 3 months later, somebody hits you up. I'm back in pain. What am I going to do? Well, accept that you're still going to heal. Accept that you're still going to get better. This is just a setback. Just accept it in a, you know, in a better reframe.
So it sounds like if you're having difficulty accepting something, you'd suggest using a different approach. Or rather than accepting, you move on to the reframe.
Yes, I would move on. Since I know the reframe real well, I would move on to the reframe. I'd use a little quick, you know, the color technique that we did last week with Bruce. They, like I said, last week they got the swish, you know, that Tony Robbins shows and so forth. You can use those and they'll knock the negative charge out of whatever might be giving you, bad vibes from something you need to accept so you can propel and be better at whatever it is you want to do in life.
All right.
I have something to say about acceptance that I've noticed. I've started the last year or two really learning, looking. There's people who, without any books or any training or anything, have a natural ability at acceptance. Like my grandmother's 101, she's one of them. But she's been like this, you know, my entire life. And I try to there's certain words that I'm noticing they all use. I have a couple of friends, old and young, a couple of relatives who I think are very skilled at acceptance. And it's not an act. They're actually really good at it. Then you can tell by their
art. I got 13 years. I learned acceptance for 13 years.
Right. Well, I haven't, but there's people that I'm in awe at how they do it.
Yeah.
And it's, they're all using certain, my grandmother, my entire life, she's used certain words when there's been situations where she had every right to be angry. Like there's a divorce and she's not allowed to see grandchildren. And that's that would normally be a cause for her to wage war, right? But she's like, well, that's
I'm getting
how,
paper.
Gotta
write this down.
My grandmother, when people are on some kind of revenge kick, you know, or some kind of, you know, she'll just say, well, I don't like it, but this is how so-and-so feels at this time. I'm hopeful she'll come around, and when she does, I'll be here waiting. You know, and then I have other friends who just have this kind of way of just, you know, accepting things. My father was one of them. He's like, well, what's the point of really fighting this internally? He would always say that to me. like, why the internal fight? It's pretty, it is what it is. And I kind of marvel at them because I've struggled with it my whole life, you know, with acceptance. I think I'm getting better, but it's still, it's easy to say when you're in agreement with what's going on, but when things are not at all, are so far out of line with everything you believe in, it's hard to say, okay, well, this is how it is. And I think Eric said something about, like, you really don't have, you know, you just have to agree to disagree. Like, you're not going to come to, I think what I notice about people who are accepting, they don't believe they have to come to a meeting on the minds of things. They just really see it for what it is. And I notice they all seem to express hope that things might change if it's kind of fundamentally maybe wrong or a bad situation for somebody. And they do use common words about this is the way it is and I'm hopeful it'll change and I'm going to be here ready. Like, they always want to take kind of be the person that can be approached after the fact, you know, and I find that impressive because I happen to know a lot of people who have no training who are really skilled at acceptance and they suffer a lot less. They suffer a lot. They still suffer, but they suffer a lot less. But I've noticed common language and I've often wondered, like, it's so far it's not really working, but I'm like, well, maybe if I say it enough, it'll happen, you know, where it's like, well, this is the way it is and I'm hopeful it changes. That's a hard, hard pill to swallow. But I'm always impressed when I see it has nothing to do with education, experience, age. It's all over the board. And I'm always
they let themselves feel those emotions.
And they say that they're disappointed. You know,
they suppress acting out on them, but they feel them authentically. Whereas somebody who's repressing, they will draw a blank face and then they'll get a stare in their eyes. You can tell the repressive personality because they've got all this rage inside that they're holding down. I think in Shakespeare, Lear says, down hysterical passio, down hysterical passion. And that creates the tragic moment, you know. We're getting back into tragic flaws in Aristotle and all this. But somebody who just suppresses their emotion, doesn't act out on it, but still feels it authentically. That's the difference between suppressing and repressing. Because when you see somebody who's repressing, then they have this blank stare and they hold their body rigid and their mouth straight across, and that's the difference. That's the unhealthy kind.
Yeah, acceptance, you don't want to repress it. Acceptance is not about repression. Acceptance is about looking for what is straight in the face and saying, okay, I can look at it this way, which is all bad, or I can look at it I can try to change it around to some way that I can accept it. So where I can keep moving on, you know, without it, without that negative thought dragging me down, you know? And when you, you know, do your little reframe, you change or whatever the thought might be. And for, let me give you an example. Okay, the guy gets his leg blown off, all right? He's standing there, he gets his leg blown off. And when he gets his leg blown off, he looks down at his leg and he says, hey, man, at least on Christmas, I'll make a good pirate. You know, he just reframed something. He accepted it. Wow. You know, I mean, that might, it's just an extreme case of a reframing acceptance. It's just a simple reframe of a thought, but you know, it's also an acceptance. You know, he knows his leg got blown off, but at the same time, you know, he's looking at it like, hey man, I'll make a great pirate. As a matter of fact, if I can just get this hand here cut off, I have a hook to go with it. You know, he's just looking at it. Yeah,
well, that seems great, but it what it does is it makes me wonder about repression, and it makes me wonder is the person really being authentic with their emotions?
You have to be.
That's what I think they are.
You think what?
I think they are being, like, what I consider my acceptance role models.
Yeah.
I don't see them. I see it like it's like a muscle. It's over and they're like, my grandmother's 101. I've seen her act this way at least 100 times.
It's a skill.
It's a skill, and she has never been one to harbor any kind of. I mean, and it's not like she's a saint or trying to be. This is just how she's functioned always. They got kicked out of Cuba. They had to come. They had no. You know, it's a typical story. They had nothing. It's like, well, at least you know we have each other. I mean, this is an endless parade of. of examples that I can recall. And and I think it's, I'm convinced it's a, I don't think I could, I'm not sure I can learn this. I almost wonder if it's a wiring issue in the brain.
You know? But when you say that it's like a muscle, when you say that it's like something that they've practiced, I've been watching a couple of videos recently by various neuroscientists, namely, so Ellen on the forum posted a TED talk about happiness and how happiness can be learned. And it had Dan Gilbert, who's a neuroscientist from Harvard. It also had Rick, and he was very interesting. He talked about how happiness can be learned, and it's a muscle. You know, you just keep practicing it, and it's within that neuroplasticity idea that seems to be making huge waves in science in the last 10, 20 years. Also, Rick Hansen. There's a couple of videos on the forum about Rick Hansen floating around. I think Mala posted one and I posted one in another thread, like in the middle of a thread, so it'd be hard to find. You could put it in the search box. But he's also amazing, and he talks about he also had the idea of you emphasize the positive, and the more you practice emphasizing the positive, like your acceptance role models. I mean, I guess it just takes years and years.
It does.
And yeah. I do a little exercise in my brain, like, you know, like the people I consider like the most positive acceptance role models. I'm like, what would, you know, I started doing it. Like, what would they do? What would they think? How would they process this? And it is helpful. It's helpful. Yeah. I have an acquaintance who, actually speaking of amputation, a brown recluse spider bit him. It went septic and his leg was amputated. And I went to see him 2 days after, and he was like, you'd think he'd just come from some, like a cruise or something. And I was like, oh my God. And I kind of knew he wouldn't be morose, but he's like, the spider got my leg. I got my life. It's a wash. You know, he was actually really happy to be alive. He's like, this leg is just a detail right now. You know, because he almost lost his life. His whole body went into shock, and it was crazy. It was a spider in a sleeping bag that bit him. But I mean, and I was thinking, I mean, God, that just didn't seem natural to me. Maybe he will mourn later, but I actually believe that he looked joyful to be alive.
Yeah.
That's the way you feel after a near-death experience.
I think so, yeah.
There's a big affirmation that comes on.
Yeah, because he didn't have just an accident. He almost died. I mean, he was also, like,
there are just people who are like this.
What?
And, you know, I'm going to say, getting back to the book, because I've always felt like this discussion group is great. If a discussion starts popping up, I say run with it, because the best discussions are the ones that arise organically. But I think the two authors of this book are also people, if you're talking about brain plasticity, you know, you think about Walt and, you know, the positivity that he's able to bring. I think that, you know, his early life experiences taught him to be positive, to see the best. And I think that's where part of his resilience comes from, the tremendous resilience that I think so many people see in Walt. And then you got Herbie, who's just got so much love and so much positivity. It's wonderful.
I had to learn the acceptance. See,
there you go. He's learned the acceptance.
Yeah, at 29 years old, at 29 years old, I didn't give up. The pain had done hit me with everything it had. I was like, man, you know, what am I going to do with my life? And I basically hit rock bottom. And in later chapters, I tell how I started church. In church for those 13 years or those 12 years there, I learned acceptance there. That's where you learn, you know, to hold your head high no matter if tornadoes come through and knock your houses down or whatever. You're going to always know that you're going to have a house twice as big, you know, sort of thoughts like that. And it turned to where when whatever happened, I'd say, hey, man, that's great, man. You know, I'm going to get sevenfold back and stuff like that. I just had an acceptance going. You know, that was the church acceptance, though. And it was different than the Dr. Sarno acceptance that I was talking about. But it still goes hand in hand. Acceptance is acceptance, you know, genuinely.
Yeah, and well, see, the thing is that you've been working on it. Herbie's been working on it for 10 years. So
yeah.
I think Yvette and I were like, we want to be cool, like her acceptance role models and like Herbie and Walt.
I would say, like, 14, so it's okay. Right. I'll give myself some time. I've been working on it long.
It'll take us some time, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
We'll start with a positive attitude about it today.
Hey, that's good. That's good. Well, y'all just get with me by myself for about 5 minutes, and we'll instill it in your bodies, and you won't be able to get it out. Go ahead.
I have a really dumb question.
Okay.
So I'm feeling a lot better physically, which is great.
Good.
I'm trying to not. Yeah, I mean it's pretty impressive. I'm trying not to think it's temporary or. You know, I'm trying not to let my brain get tricky.
Yeah, just be in the flow. Don't even worry about,
when will all this return? When will the nightmare start again? So I'm pretty much keeping that at bay pretty good by doing certain things. But
great to hear.
It's so funny because now I'm feeling well, and I've had, like, the worst sore throat for 2 weeks. And I'm like, I went to the doctor today, and she's like, there's nothing wrong with your throat. I'm like, okay, is this a form of TMS? Like, now my body feels better. And I think it's an allergy, to be honest with you. I'm like, okay, this is like crazy that I can't feel 100% good even for one day. And I thought it was kind of and I'm kind of treating it the way I've treated,
an affirmation when you say that, you know, like when you say I can't even feel good for one day, your subconscious doesn't know that you don't mean that, you know?
I know, but it's crazy because I'm trying to treat this like persistent, ridiculous sore throat that apparently has no basis other than irritation. Like I am the TMS, which is like, this is passing, this is going to go away. Awesome. Let me not give it too much importance. But it's just, I just couldn't believe it. And I think it's still tied into like, I'm not, you know, I haven't really allowed myself the freedom to say, yeah, I'm going to feel great. You know, like something's got to. And now I'm on a terrible timeline because, it's, like, my daughter's graduating from college in 10 days and involves a long trip, and she's graduating top of her class, and, like, obviously it's one of the highlights of my life, and I'm, like, the stress of, I want to be really healthy for this experience, you know? And that's the type of thing that gives me trouble when I'm anticipating a problem that's going to stand in the way of something I really want, you know? And it's ridiculous, because, like, there's nothing wrong with me, you know?
When you think about it, Yvette, Do you see yourself in your mind's eye, everything going great at your daughter's graduation or whatever?
I'm scared because every time something big comes, there's some big health setback right before that causes a problem.
When you think about it,
that too will pass.
Yeah, if you think about it in your mind, though, do you see an image of something bad going on?
I'm trying to, but I've been slapped down so many times that it's hard, but I'm truly trying to. I'm really... You know, my own mother's like, there's no reason on earth. Like, well, in my mind, nothing will, like, wild horses can't keep me away from this. If I had to be put on a medevac to go to graduation, I would.
Sure when you go there, you think in your mind, this is going to be the best graduation ever, and I'm going to feel it all the way through.
I need to start
And it'll usually turn out that way.
I'm a little afraid just because of past big moments that have been tarnished by my, like, my debilitating pain or herniated disc or... whatever back issue came up, you know. So I find the throat thing funny because it's like, okay, I'm keeping the back thing under control, but now I have a brand new throat ache. That's crazy.
Yeah,
I think it's all part of the process, you know. But I think it's good. I need to start envisioning the best day ever.
That's it. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Your magical moment.
Our dad and I have worked really hard for this day, so we're like, this is our day too, you know.
Yeah. It's great. That's great, Yvette. Wonderful.
Good stuff.
And you give quite a bit of advice, Herbie, following acceptance about reducing anxiety. Sometimes anxiety begins to manifest when you get rid of the pain. Dr. Alan Garden says that that's actually another mask it puts on.
Like a sore throat.
And you give a lot of advice about how to reduce anxiety via affirmations.
Yes, in this chapter, yeah.
Yeah, you give about 10 of them. I accept myself as I am. I am a good and loving person. I forgive and let go easily. I am calm, relaxed, and confident. I am the head and not the tail. I'm above and not beneath. I'm blessed in the city. I'm blessed in the country. I'm blessed going out and coming in. Everything I lay my hands to is blessed. As you say these words, feel forgiveness. also at the same time. I guess do it in a good spirit then. But yeah, I noticed that with EFT tapping, with the affirmations that you use during it.
Yeah, if you can feel each time you say it, if you can feel what you're saying, go ahead. See, a lot of people, they'll say the affirmation, but they just say it, you know, and they don't imagine what feeling, what the emotion feels like, or what this, you know, what this affirmation is being said feels like. Like, I forgive and let go easily. Right then and there, accept that you are forgiven, you know, all the pressures you're holding in and stuff, and feel what it feels like to have no unforgiveness in your body. If it's just to pretend to start with, you know, if it's just to pretend like you're just going to let all this unforgiveness go, then do it for the momentary time like that. But for sure, feel what unforgiveness feels like. It's a beautiful thing.
I think when you recite these affirmations, if you're only doing it pro forma, ritualistically, and using the words, they don't have the same kind of effect if you do them in conjunction with deep breathing. I think actually tapping on the acupuncture points gives them a visceral body-mind connection at the same time.
Like with me, with
the breathing does too. Any way to make these affirmations concrete for your body, so you associate them with yourself intimately, instead of just like something you repeat over and over again. But if you can connect it with your breath, with something you're doing, with some kind of ritual movement like Tai Chi. I think that makes them have more power, I guess, as what you'd say as a magical invocation, maybe.
Well, you know, there's lots of different ways to do affirmations. One of the main ways that I like to do affirmations is lay down, get in a meditative state or a relaxed state, you know. As I'm laying there, tell myself I'm calm and feel that, and relaxed and patient and confident, and feel those emotions of calmness, relaxed. Being relaxed and confident, but at the same time, I'm laying down and I'm feeling these emotions. And then when I get done with those, I'll do like I'll tell my face to relax, like I've said on here before, and I'll go all the way down to my toes. By the time I'm done with that, and then I start repeating these affirmations that I already know by mind, then my body starts feeling these, and I start feeling real good. Now that's when I'm under a relaxed meditative state, saying my affirmations. Now all through the day, I'll be saying affirmations like, you know, I don't have a spirit of fear, but a power of love and a sound mind. I can do all things, you know, and so forth. All day long, I'm saying these affirmations of calmness, these calming affirmations, these soothing affirmations, these affirmations of courage and of strength and stuff like that. And if I could get all those just pouring in me throughout the day, then I noticed that the more I'd done it, when that night came, that I realized in my mind that I had control over this tension in my body, that's the affirmations was a very, very important part of that. It was good, but you have to get yourself conditioned to those affirmations.
Yeah, I noticed that just sitting there like a drill sergeant and repeating the 12 key thoughts doesn't work nearly as well as if I do deep breathing for 5 minutes first, get very calm, bring the thought and the feeling, the sense, and the idea in conjunction some way.
I like that. That's it.
Makes it more effective, yeah.
That's it. That's the whole idea, Bruce. That's the whole idea, bringing it all together, and then you're basically a walking affirmation, you know? You're basically a walking affirmation, you know? Everything you do anyway is just an affirmation. That's all it is. Everything you do, everything you think, all day long, it's just an affirmation. And if you can become that walking affirmation, wow, you know, that's when Dr. Sarno's techniques and all of that will really sink in, really start the penicillin, the knowledge penicillin. That's when it'll really, like you said, it's 12 reminders. Like when you was talking about how to get them and feel them and really have them as a part of you, that's when they'll start working a lot better for you than sitting there. Like the story I told about the lady, and I asked her, I said, how do you say your affirmations? And she said them so fast, you know, I knew she wasn't feeling them. I knew that that was just, you know, something she just recited. But when you can really feel those affirmations, that's when the healing starts.
It's like being a method actor. You have to feel the character while you recite the lines.
Yes. Otherwise,
method affirmations, we could call it.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. See Marlon Brando.
That is it, bro. The ignore method was something that I wrote down today that I noticed, you know, a lot of people that come to the TMS Wiki, sometimes they don't understand what it means, because there's, on the TMS Wiki, we understand that we talk about two different types of focus. One of them is focusing on, you know, the negative focus on the body and keeping your mind on structural thoughts. And that focus is the type of focus that I talk about in this chapter. Chapter two, but there's another focusing that's Eugene Jenlin style, and that's where you basically, it's like a mindfulness. The way I do it, it's sort of like mindfulness, but you know, you think about the pain, but you don't judge it, you don't criticize it, you just let it be without trying to run from it. You know, you actually feel the emotion in your body that's connected to the pain or whatever. That's going to be for later chapters. But for this chapter, for the ignore method, you've got the negative focus, you know? And you think, well, if I ain't supposed to focus on it, if I can't think about the body, then how am I supposed to do my work to heal, you know? So one of the ways is, one of the ways we learned from Steve-O, you know, you might be hurting in your left knee, think about your left knee, you know, so, and focus on the left knee more so, you know, and there is disassociative, you can disassociate yourself from pain and other things. It's not in the book. I'm not going to really talk about that right now, but the ignore method is basically getting your mind on something else other than the pain. And people say, well, how do I do that when I'm hurting? Well, it's a skill too. You have to learn to be able to get your mind on, well, again, get your mind on another part of your body, get your mind on a hobby, get your mind on anything you can get your mind on. Well, we talk about talking psychological, right? We talk about getting your mind on the emotions, right? Well, a lot of times when people wants to do physical activities, they need to get their mind specifically on the physical activity and not on the pain in their body.
I notice if I go walking down the street and think about the pain in my left leg and I lead with that left leg, then it will get worse. However, right. If I decide to lead in my pace with my right leg, the good leg, pretty soon the left leg just goes along with it and I don't feel any pain in the left leg.
It's yes, like, that is the ignore method. That's perfect.
Yeah, that's what. It's funny how that works too, because if you keep your mind, well, I've learned that from mindfulness meditation, how to put my consciousness into my right leg.
And, I like that. Yes.
Yeah, learning that technique, but it does work. Woiks, as Walt would say.
Yeah, you need to be able to think in your mind and be able to feel what the energy in your hands. You need to be able to think and feel, you know, what the inside of your shoulders feel like. You need to be able to feel what your legs feel like just by your mind, you know. And that's in one session, it's called a body scan or something like that. But if you can get to where you can scan your body and feel different parts of your body, you're going a long way when it comes to being able to use a lot of skills that we use in TMS healing.
Yeah, that's an important skill. I think that's the first one of the meditations in Howard Schubner's Unlearn Your Pain in his CD. That's the one that gets you ready for the next ones.
Yes. Yes.
Because once you got that, you don't need the next ones. That's what's funny about
exactly.
It. If you've learned that really well, if you've learned that technique really well, then everything else would just follow.
Yes. See, like now, if something goes real bad or whatever it might be, and I can start to feel a little tightness come over on the right side of my back or something, I just tell it to stop. And just like within a split second, it'll go away. Say, for instance, headaches or something like that. they start to come on me. And I noticed that if I look with my eyes, like if it's on the right side of my head, if I look with my eyes to the right side of my head and just tell it in my mind to stop, it goes away instantly. But if I don't look that way with my eye and tell it, when I tell it to stop, it stay. So I have a way to look over with my eye at that, where, like, say if it's on top of my head, I look up, I tell it to stop, it leaves. It's like, hey, man, he knows what I'm doing. So I'm going to listen to him. You know, it's the unconscious is listening to your thoughts as you say them in your mind.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it sounds a little bit like EMDR. And some of those exercises you do in EFT with your eyes.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about that.
Yeah, there's a lot to that. Breaking that obsessive scanning that is very typical of someone who's anxious.
Oh, yes. And see, that's a negative
conscious, self-conscious movement of the eyes and scanning the horizon and so on.
Yes. And see, most people already know how to focus on their bodies and go all over their bodies because they do it when they're in pain. You know, let somebody have a big toe hurt. They'll focus on that. Their whole attention will be totally on that toe, you know, and they already know how to do this. The thing is, you know, opening their their awareness to it is that you already know how to focus on the pain in the right and the left toe. Why don't you focus on the right toe for a while and see what happens to the pain in the left toe? Get your attention
somewhere else. Ralph Waldo Emerson has an essay called Circles, where he talks about how you can increase your powers of vision by studying the horizon. He's talking about the circles, the lines of sight, how that gives you a perspective on your own situation. And he says that's one important benefit of being out in the wilderness, because you're looking at that circle all the time instead of obsessing, you know, on your limited little self. You're looking at that line of convergence on the horizon.
Getting out of your body.
My optometrist told me today in an eye exam that people that are outdoors on a regular basis, especially if they live out in the wilderness, have better vision long-term than anyone who's indoors, because when you scan, when you're required, because we spend most of our day close in, looking close in, but when you're required to, he said it's not the distance, it's the focusing from short to far constantly that creates a much stronger eye muscle. And he said that they're also, you know, like he says, and you could really assume that they're probably calmer inside too, but he says that what makes the eye muscle stronger is focusing distance and close in constantly. But he says anybody in the city will get, anybody who lives in a metropolitan area will have eye problems younger than anyone in the wilderness. And they know that for a fact because of that scanning ability. And maybe there's something to it. He just threw in anecdotally, I bet they're happier too. Mm-hmm. And, but maybe there is much more to it than just anecdotally, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It isn't just eye mechanics. It's what that's doing to your brain at the same time.
Right. He says definitely eye mechanics are at work, but he says I wouldn't be surprised if they're just happier because of that ability.
Yeah. One of the things I researched when I was studying economics was self-reported happiness. And I don't recall exactly what's happening in the long-term trends of self-reported happiness, but it doesn't seem to be going up. Certainly not compared to how much we're consuming. Levels of depression certainly don't seem to be going down. Perhaps they're going up. And you kind of wonder if urbanization has something to do with that.
Yeah.
And the way that lives are changing. That's one of the reasons why I love listening to Walt. He tells us how things used to be.
Great. Peggy, do you have any questions?
No, I do have something to say about the sore throat, though.
Okay.
Cute.
Sore throat for 8 years.
So annoying.
I've had my sore throat for 8 years. I've had it scanned. I've had lots of tests done. There's nothing wrong with it. I think it's sort of like the Shania Twain syndrome, where she called it something, but I don't remember the name. But she got, her husband left her, and she got a sore throat for 5 years. And so did Lionel Richie. Lionel Richie went through a long period of sore throat. Anyway.
You know, actually, Forrest Smith might be added to that list.
Really?
Yes. I think once I started getting used to the problems that I was having in my hands, neck, shoulders, back, knee, etc., around that time is when I started having a sore throat, and I went to an ear, nose, and throat doctor. They sent me to a voice therapist. You know, I had something stuck up my nose and down my whatever. I don't even remember where it went for a day, and they were like, no, you don't have GERD. Gastroesophageal reflux disease. And I was like, well, why does my throat hurt? And it was TMS, is my understanding now. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was actually very suspicious. I mean, my doctor's like, it's irritated. You know, I had a cold, I had a legitimate cold, but she said it's a post nasal drip. And I was like, this is just, yeah, I'm going to treat it like it's going to pass and it's a TMS thing. And it's, you know, wakes me up in the middle of the night, which is annoying, which is what my back used to do. So it's almost funny. Yeah, it's almost funny. So, like, I think, yeah.
Well, the funnier it is, the better.
Yeah, exactly.
What I notice is the TMS would prevent me from doing certain things because I was afraid of having an attack. But when I look back, when I was a kid, before my parents died, I had asthma. So I was afraid of going different places because I'd have an asthma attack. And then when I have TMS, I'm afraid of going someplace because I'll have a TMS attack. They both perform the same psychological function. And they're both obviously psychosomatic, obviously PPD.
Right, and the key thing is, like, the throat is red. It's like it's an actual manifestation, you know, but it's like... I think it's happening for a reason.
And also, I've been going through healing in my left leg. Last week, I noticed that my old broken heel from 20 years ago was getting red marks on it.
Oh my God.
As if it was re-healing. The process was going on over again. And the pain, instead of being in my back, had moved down through my thigh and then was concentrated in my foot. It's obviously going on inside of the central nervous system. It's not really physical, or what do you call that? It's got physical manifestations, and yet it's got to do with something that's been learned in those pain pathways. And now that's gone away. And I woke up and I saw it and I was afraid. I said, oh no, have I got an infection in my old broken foot? Again, fear. It's like, once
fear
you
is figure huge.
Stuff out. And then I said, I'll ignore it and I won't pay any attention to it. And then gradually it went away and wasn't there anymore. It's very weird, this business with this stuff. But once you're onto it.
Right.
You can call its bluff.
I also think we heal in reverse order. So the most recent will heal quick. So my sore back, I've only had for 2 or 3 years. But my sore throat, I've had for 8 years. So to me, it's more subtle and deeper, maybe in some ways. Hard to figure out. I also have not yawned in 8 years, just so you know.
Oh my God. Peggy, how do you live with a sore throat for 8 years?
It's not all bad. I mean, it's improved over 8 years a lot.
Okay.
And then it only gets worse when I get nervous or I have to go somewhere. If I have to go out instead of having an asthma attack, I have a sore throat. But no, it's not bad during the day and stuff. It's not too bad.
That mind-body connection.
Yeah, it's something to figure out. It's a little deeper, so it takes a little more figuring.
A friend of mine went through psychotherapy, intense psychotherapy for a lot of stuff, and she got throat polyps as she was doing it. Actual polyps had to be operated on. And her therapist says, wow, you're just getting your voice, and now she lost her voice. And then they had surgery and it came back. But it was, you know, it was kind of in the most intense part of the therapy that she got these polyps that disabled her voice. And she doesn't believe it was a coincidence at all. She'd never been prone to that in her whole life, so. Am I getting polyps? I don't.
No. Wow. I don't think so either. This too will pass.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, guys. I mean, this has been a long show here. Is everything good? Is that sound like a wrap?
It's good.
Good?
I think it does. Thanks everyone for sharing your experiences.
We just have to remember that we have to look beyond what our eyes see, guys. You know, we have to look with our hearts. We have to learn what acceptance is. We it's good to get affirmations down. It's good to understand what really awareness means. You know, it's good to know that pain is a habit that you focused on for a lot of years. It's good to know about your impressions and how to come to decisions and about all of this. So with that being said, next week we'll go to chapter 3. Each chapter will proceed on to the last chapter, and we'll just delve deeper and deeper and deeper until we get to a total understanding of the whole puzzle here. Okay?
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. I'm going for the night. Bruce, thank you, Forrest, Yvette, Peggy.
Thank you, Herbie.
Thank you all. Thanks.
Thank you all. God bless you. Bye-bye.